Eugenio Bianchi, who's going to speak about entanglement and the Bekenstein entropy. Eugenio?
Hello, everybody, and thank you, Jorge, for the opportunity to contribute to our International Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar. Yes, today I would like to tell you about entanglement and Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. This is recent work that I've been doing after my last telephone seminar. In fact, it's motivated by what I told you about in the last seminar, and it's not only motivated, but most of this work has really come out from reactions and feedback that I got last time. So what I'm going to present today is not in the framework of loop quantum gravity, is in a perturbative gravity framework. So the talk is organized in two parts. In the first part, I present a calculation of entanglement entropy and its relation with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And in the last part, we'll discuss the relevance of this result and why this result is interesting for loop quantum gravity. And in particular, I will mention recent work that I've been doing with Rob Myers here at Perimeter. So two topics, entanglement and the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Let me introduce briefly the second of the two. We can go to slide two, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. This is a very general result that I'm going to present first for the case of a black hole, for instance a Schwarzschild black hole. What Bekenstein and Hawking considered is a process where you let some matter fall into a black hole. The result is that the mass of the black hole increases, its area increases, and the entropy of the black hole changes by an amount that is universal and given by the change in area divided by 4g Newton. And it's immediate to derive this result for the Schwarzschild black hole once you have computed the temperature of the black hole using Clausius relation. But the interesting aspect of this Bekenstein-Hawking formula is that it's universal. It holds for all sorts of black holes, in fact for all sorts of horizons. It holds also for cosmological horizons and local acceleration of horizons. And as you all know, the puzzle, the big question is, this is the entropy of what? How do we derive this entropy? And there's lots of work that has been done on this topic, especially in loop quantum gravity. So this is the first of the topics. The second is on page three. It's vacuum entanglement. Again, this is an old idea that goes back to Raphael Sorkin in 83. And the idea is the simplest possible setting is just a free scalar field on Minkowski space, and you consider the ground state, the vacuum state. And from the fact that there are correlations in the vacuum, correlations at space-like separation, one finds that that this state is entangled. In particular, more specifically, if I consider a region as in the picture, the region in, modes within this region are entangled with modes outside the region, so that when one computes the reduced density matrix, this density matrix is mixed. A way to understand why there's entanglement between two regions is to look at the Hamiltonian of the system. The Hamiltonian is not the sum of H in plus H out. It has a coupling between the two regions that is in fact written in the potential term, in the term of phi, Laplacian phi. And as a result, the vacuum state is entangled. Now, you have a density matrix. It's mixed because of entanglement, and you can compute the von Neumann entropy of this density matrix. And it turns out to be infinite because most of the correlations are in the ultraviolet. And to study how it diverges, the standard way is to introduce an ultraviolet cutoff, a cutoff in energy, lambda. And when you do this, you find that the entropy diverges like lambda square and scales with the area of the boundary of this region in. And it has corrections. Corrections that are in four dimensions, logarithmic and finite terms. Now, this is a fact. It's a fact about quantum field theory. And clearly, when you see that the entropy scales as the area of the boundary of the region, it's natural to ask if this is related to black hole entropy. In fact, if you have a good reason to believe that the physical cutoff is at the Planck scale, then you find that the leading term is in the entropy is area over G. That really looks like the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It would explain Bekenstein-Hawking entropy if you were able to solve these two problems that I indicated here. The first one is that in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, you have area over 4G. And this 4 seems to be universal, seems to be a universal property of the entropy. And apparently, if you simply introduce a cutoff at the Planck scale, you should tune this cutoff to get C0 to be 1/4. And the second aspect is that the problem is, in fact, more difficult. And the reason is that this is just the entropy of one scalar field. But suppose that you have a few scalar fields, for instance, 7 scalar fields. You would have that the entropy is 7 times C0 area over G Newton. So you should tune your cutoff in a way that knows how many species of fields you have. And in fact, this knows all the physics from low energies up to the Planck scale, because going to higher and higher energies, you will be unfreezing more and more degrees of freedom. Yes, is there a question? Okay. There's a lot of work that has been done in this direction, studying this entanglement entropy. There's a beautiful review, a living review by Sergei Solodokhin on this topic. What I'm going to present today is something different, is a new result that does not involve high energy physics up to the cutoff scale. In fact, what I consider is not the entropy in itself, but how the entropy changes in a low energy process. And what I find is that the entropy change, the entanglement entropy change is finite. And if you take into account gravity, gravitational back reaction, this is not just finite, but is universal. And turns out to be given exactly by the change in area divided by 4G. So it reproduces exactly the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula. Are there questions up to this point? And I should ask also if you can hear me well and you are still there.
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, we can hear you. Actually, I have a question. There was some work by Donnelly a few years ago finding entanglement entropy in loop quantum gravity. Are you going to refer to that later? Or?
Yes, I'm certainly going to refer to it later when I'm trying to draw relations with loop quantum gravity. And in particular, William Donnelly is here with us here at Perimeter, so I may intervene if he has comments on this. I definitely believe that the series of works is relevant for extending these results in loop quantum gravity.
Thank you.
Anyway. Okay. So the aim now is to present a derivation of this result, a step-by-step calculation. And first of all, I should state what are the approximations, the assumptions that I'm going to make. I'm speaking only about low-energy processes, and speaking about low-energy processes allows me to make statements that are independent of the specific theory of quantum gravity that you have. It will be independent of the ultraviolet completion. And so this is considering only energies that are small compared to the scale of the physical cutoff, only energies that are small compared to the Planck scale. The other approximation is one in infrared, is a local approximation. Like the one that has been discussed in a recent telephone seminar by Alejandro Perez. It is discussed on page 4, on slide 4. So let's go back to the case of a black hole and consider, for instance, an observer that is hovering over the horizon at very small distance. And let something fall in, for instance, a stone that falls into the black hole. Now, the stone is freely falling, and by the equivalence principle, we'll see just Minkowski space on a scale that is small compared to the curvature radius. So the approximation that I will make is all the perturbations that I will consider have a typical scale. If it's a quantum process, they have a typical wavelength that is small compared to the curvature radius. And to be more concrete, if you consider, for instance, the black hole that is at the center of our galaxy, at the center of the Milky Way, this is a black hole of a few million solar masses that has an horizon radius that is 2% of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, 0.02 astronomical units. And this is also the scale of the curvature. The curvature scale has over the horizon radius square at the horizon. So the point is that for a black hole of this kind, space-time near the horizon is not very different from how it is in this room here, and also there where you are, Alice. So the approximation that I will make is to focus on local aspects. Local aspects are seen by a near-horizon observer. And this is a very general set of ideas that has been advocated by Ted Jacobson and Renaud Parentani in a beautiful review called Horizon Entropy, and that is also playing an important role in loop quantum gravity. So I will use this approximation and I will rely on it. So everything that follows is in this approximation of small scales compared to the scale of curvature. Are there questions on this slide?
Yeah, so first of all, on the top of the slides, you have a thing which says causal horizon. What does that mean?
I just mean horizon. In this case, there's the process is still non-dynamical, so I just mean event horizon, and I'm not attaching any special meaning to this word causal horizon now.
But you're assuming it to be null, is it? Is that the statement?
I'm assuming that it is null, that's right.
And just to make sure that I understand, so when you say that the wavelengths are much smaller than the radius of the horizon, then that means that the frequencies are arbitrarily large, right?
Well, not arbitrarily large. I think it's... I'm making the same approximation we usually make when we use quantum field theory, for instance, at LHC. It is, we assume that the wavelengths are small compared to the horizon radius, and in fact they are even smaller than the size of the laboratory. But they don't have to be so small to involve physics that is beyond low energy physics.
So then there's another inequality which you did not write down, is that right?
That's right. So
inequality on the right-hand side. I mean, so something is much less than D is much less than D, than RH.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Exactly. So this is the other side of the approximation. That is, I want the process to be low energy compared to the scale of quantum gravity. And as I'm focusing on these low energy processes, I can use a framework for quantum gravity that we do have. It is quantum gravity at low energies seen as an effective field theory of graviton. And that's what I'm going to discuss in the following. So on page 5, there's the plan of the calculation, the plan of my derivation, step-by-step derivation. I will go slowly through each step and discuss each one of them. And in particular, on slide 6, I'm reminding you about this framework of low energy quantum gravity or perturbative quantum gravity about flat space. So the framework is the following. You just consider a Minkowski background and a massless spin 2 field, the graviton. And you can understand it as a fluctuation of the Minkowski background, magnetic fluctuation. And the action for the graviton coupled to matter is the sum of the free graviton action plus the matter action, the free matter action, and the universal coupling between gravitons and the energy momentum tensor of everything, of matter and gravitons in themselves. And you can obtain this action simply taking the Einstein-Hilbert action plus matter and expand it perturbatively using this formula G mu nu equal Minkowski metric plus perturbation. But here, in the following, I really take a point of view, a particle physicist point of view, like it is done in these beautiful lectures by Feynman. So I will really present everything in this perspective, where we do have a background and we have these gravitons, these low energy fluctuations. And what you gain doing this is that you have a framework, a well-developed framework, that you know when to trust. You can trust it in low energy processes when you regard this theory as an effective field theory. So this is the other side of my approximation. I'm restricting attention to processes that are low energies, of low energy compared to the Planck scale, or if you want, the wavelength is small compared to the radius of curvature, but large compared to the Planck scale. Okay, so what I need of this framework, in particular in the following, is the equation of motion for the graviton. That is the equation with the name start, the circled equation. You obtain it just varying the action with respect to the graviton field, and notice that on the right-hand side you have the energy momentum tensor, and keep in mind that this is the energy momentum tensor as a particle physicist would define it. That is, it has a graviton part, free graviton, plus a matter part, plus terms that correspond to interactions between gravitons and matter. And in the following, I will work perturbatively in square root of G, and in particular, to simplify things and really present the leading order, I will always truncate everything at lowest order in square root of G. Okay, so this concludes step one. If you go to slide 7, you see that I put the equation that I need on the slide, and now we can move to step 2. The Rindler horizon and its perturbation. Okay, in slide 8 I just reviewed standard material. I guess it's familiar to everybody. I'm just speaking about Minkowski space, introducing Cartesian coordinates and Rindler coordinates, and telling you that an accelerated observer with acceleration A, it is equal to 1 over L, sits at a distance rho equal L from this bifurcation point, it is x equal 0, t equal 0, and his proper time is L times eta. In particular, the future Rindler horizon that I'm calling H is the light-like surface in radii in the picture. Okay, so this is the Rindler horizon. Now I'm interested in perturbations of this Rindler horizon. We can go to slide 9. So I think that the most straightforward way to explain this is the following. So let me first start considering the following process. I have a flashlight, and I'm sitting here on the left of the screen, and I'm pointing towards the right. And my flashlight has a beam that is collimated, and has an area that is A0. Now, in the unperturbed case, if the beam is collimated, it will go straight and give and have a final area that is still A0. However, if there's some energy crossing the beam, then there will be gravitational back reaction, And as we know that gravity is attractive, we will have that it focuses light rays. And in particular, the beam will be focused and the area will start going down. Now, this is something that is familiar in general relativity, is the fact that if there's curvature, we have a deviation of geodesics, and in particular one can study the expansion of congruence of null geodesics, and the ratio of the equation tell us about how this expansion changes in time. But as I told you before, I'm really working in this perturbative framework, this particle physicist point of view, so I would like to explain everything only in terms of flat space and small perturbations of a flat space. And it's interesting to notice that you can recover the same phenomenon in this framework. And what you gain is that you have a nice perturbative expansion in square root of G. In particular, you have that this beam will be focused. And the reason is that when there's some energy density passing through the beam, because of the wave equation that gives you the reaction, the back reaction there, the behavior of H mu nu when there's some energy momentum tensor, you would have some non-vanishing H mu nu at some point, and this will deflect the right trace. Okay, so this is what happens to a collimated beam, and now I want to discuss how this is also a perturbation of the horizon, of the event horizon. And this perturbation of the event horizon, I'm calling it the perturbed Swindler horizon. Are there questions? Okay, then we can move to slide.
Yes? The Swindler horizon is not an event horizon, right? So I'm a bit confused about your going back and forth between the two.
Okay, so the Swindler horizon is an horizon for the set of observers that follow the hyperbolic motions, the one associated to Swindler observers. So it's not an event
the
horizon.
The whole point about the kind of the event horizon is that it is not observer dependent, right? I mean, in the sense that light rays are completely trapped. I mean, null infinity is complete, and light cannot escape to null infinity. Here, null infinity is not complete. This may not be relevant for what goes on, but I'm uncomfortable with using Swindler horizon as event horizon. And the second thing is that, in fact, if you are going to consider back reaction as you are here, right?
Yes.
Then, of course, the event horizon changes. Right?
Yes.
So if I were, for example, a Schwarzschild black hole and I got some event horizon sitting there for a billion years and I drop a little mass in it, then the event horizon is not where I thought it was, right? Because I had to go to infinity and trace back. And therefore, the previous thing which I thought was the event horizon is not the event horizon. And one should not confuse the two. And I'm not clear here as whether you're looking at some null surface in the background, are you really looking at event horizon, including the back reaction, or what?
Yeah, I see your point. You're right. So when one speaks about the event horizon, one generally says it's not observer dependent, and the way one is defining it is in terms of null infinity. Now what I'm considering is a local notion of horizon. It's local in space but not in time, and it's associated to a set of observers, so it's definitely observer dependent. And so I'm considering the boundary of the set of events that can affect a set of observers that are these Swindler observers. And these have many properties in common with event horizons, but it's a much more local notion. And also in this case, there's back reaction. When there's back reaction, there's a teleological notion of horizon. I have to update it, and it's what I'm going to discuss in a moment. But you are completely right. In the case of Minkowski, I should not call it event horizon is an observer-dependent notion. It really depends on the set of observers that I'm considering.
Thank you.
Okay, so we can go to slide 10, where I tell you about this teleological aspect. So I'm considering now back reaction, and that is the fact that light rays are focused, and the local causal horizon, the perturbed Schindler horizon, is defined by light rays that are finally balanced between going out of sight of my set of observers and reaching infinity. So in particular, for having that, I need that the beam at infinity is collimated, and to have it collimated after matter has passed, it has to start diverging. So the final area that I'm calling here area H, area of the horizon, is different from the initial area E0. In fact, it's larger, and one can compute the area increase, and one can compute it in this perturbative framework, and is given by the formula that is circled in blue here. So the final area is the initial area plus a quantity that is given by how light rays are deflected. And this is the analog of the calculation one does with the Reich-Hadoury equation, integrating the Reich-Hadoury equation in the analysis of event horizons for a black hole. But it is a local version. So are there questions on this point? It's an important point in the following.
Just tell us what V is, just so that everybody is the same wavelength. What the coordinate V?
So it's defined on slide 8. You have X and T that are the Cartesian coordinates, and V is just X plus T. And as we are in a perturbative framework, I know that at leading order in square root of G, these are just the same X. V is just X plus T. From a covariant general relativity point of view, V is the affine coordinate along this null rays. But here in this perturbative framework, it's just simply X plus T.
I have a question. Can you tell us more about the validity of this equation for AH? That is, do you assume, I don't know, perturbation in G Newton? Do you assume that it's only matter falling inside, or do you assume that gravity waves fall inside? When is it true? When is it not true?
Okay, so this is the right first order in perturbation of square root of G. And as you see, there's matter doesn't appear in the formula. There's only H mu nu. And the idea is that it holds both if there's matter falling through and if there are gravitational waves crossing this Schindler horizon. And the other point that I would like to make is that you can derive this at the classical level, but here really the point is that you should understand this AEH as an operator. In fact, H mu nu, the graviton field, is an operator. So in particular, you can take the expectation value of this AH on a state, for instance, on the ground state, or on an excited state. An excited state corresponds to gravitons crossing the horizon or matter crossing the horizon. Okay, so we can move to slide 11, where I put this formula that I will use in the following, and there's still an important point that I would like to tell you about that is still related to the Schindler horizon. So we can move to slide 12, where I introduce the notion of generator or boost in the quantum theory. So let's start first classical. So K, the Schindler energy, is defined in this way. K mu is the boost ceiling vector. I'm starting with Minkowski space. Minkowski is Lorentz invariant, in particular is invariant on the boost. And one can compute these quantities. This quantity is the integral of a sparse transection sigma. It is a section of constant eta. One can compute the flux through this section or the energy current associated to this Killing vector. And this quantity is conserved, doesn't depend on eta. And in particular, if no energy escapes to infinity, then you can evaluate it on the Rindler horizon H. And there on the Rindler horizon has this form that is circled here. It's k mu nu contrasted with k mu k nu, where k is the tangent vector to the horizon. Now, this quantity is something that you can define already at the classical level, but I will be especially interested in it at the quantum level. In fact, you are already familiar with this at the quantum level for a free scalar field, for instance. This is just the definition of the Hermitian generator of boosts in the quantum theory. And in particular, if you want to make a finite boost, you exponentiate it. E to the I eta k generates a boost in direction x with parameter with rapidity eta. And the other remark is that this quantity is also related to something that an accelerated observer measures. In fact, notice that k is dimensionless. It's not an energy. It's the generator of boosts. But if you recall the relation between the boost Killing vector and the tangent vector to the world line here in blue, the one of an accelerated observer with acceleration a, you have that this is the Killing vector normalized to one over this trajectory that I'm calling here u mu. It is simply acceleration times chi. And when you put it inside the formula for the energy flux through the horizon, you find that the energy flux through the horizon as measured by this observer is simply A times K. Okay. And,
so one quick question. So you mentioned that you can think of this as being a generator in the quantum theory. So you are thinking of Minkowski space, Fock space, because T mini will have to be regularized. And are you thinking of just normal ordering with respect to Minkowski vacuum, or are you doing something more sophisticated as using some other vacuum to regularize
Yes, the first one, the simplest one. I'm thinking about Fock space with the ordinary Minkowski vacuum. And for a free theory, mu nu, and I'm simply doing normal ordering. Now, the interesting thing is that you can define this for a free theory, but you can define it also for an interacting theory when you treat it perturbatively. So you would have that the Minkowski vacuum can be corrected order by order in perturbation theory and will be still invariant on the boost, where the generator of boost is still this k, where t mu nu now is not the t mu nu of a free scalar field, but it's the t mu nu of the interacting theory. In particular, I'm interested in this object in the case of perturbative quantum gravity, where you have the flat background, you have a Fock space, a Fock-Hilbert space, but now it's a Fock-Hilbert space of, for instance, a scalar field and gravitons. Now these are lowest order in perturbation theory in square root of G. It's simply the free Minkowski vacuum of gravitons, a tensor free Minkowski vacuum of Fock vacuum of scalars. However, first order in perturbation theory, it's not anymore so simple. There's interaction between the two, but still you can compute it at leading order. There will be interaction and entanglement between the two, corrections of order square root of g. And similarly, the energy momentum tensor will have an interaction term. And still this quantity by construction is the generator of boosts. So the idea here is really to use it order by order in perturbation theory, in a theory of gravitons and matter on flux space.
Okay, thank you. So it really just boosts energy. The word Rindler energy suggested to me that you were using some Rindler vacuum to regularize, but you're not doing that. It is just boosts energy in Minkowski space. Thank you.
Yeah, that's exact. That's exact. Yeah, it's just boost energy in Minkowski space. And the comment is the Rindler vacuum would be the eigenstate of zero, eigenstate of K at value zero. Yeah, but the state that we'll be considering is the Minkowski vacuum. I'm not changing the framework of ordinary quantum field theory. I'm just taking the standard Minkowski vacuum. This is boost invariant. Okay, so slide 13. I'm showing the formula that I will need in the following is this formula for the generator of boost K written as an integral over the horizon. Okay, now we can move to slide 14 where I tell you about entanglement and thermality of the vacuum, of the Minkowski vacuum. So first for a phase scalar field of Minkowski. This is standard and familiar. It's the fact that the Minkowski vacuum has as correlations at space-like separations. In particular, if you choose a surface, for instance, the x equals zero surface in four dimensions that splits space into parts, like only in the left and right, you find that the Minkowski vacuum has entanglement between modes on the left and on the right, and in particular it can be written in this form as a sum of states n, and these states are eigenstates of the boost Hamiltonian, of the boost generator K. In particular, the state n equals zero would be the Rindler vacuum that I was mentioning before. And one can take a basis that diagonalizes K. And it turns out that the Minkowski vacuum has this property. It can simply be written as the sum of n over these states and left tensor and right with weights that are e to the minus pi epsilon n, where epsilon n is the eigenvalue of the boost operator. And this is a very general fact. It can be shown in detail in the case of a free scalar field, for instance, but it's much more general. In fact, the origin of this pi in e to the minus pi epsilon can be derived in a formal part integral way, and is given by the Euclidean version of the boost, by the rotation that you need to rotate the section indicated as right in left, to rotate it by pi. Now, this is a property, it's a fact for a free scalar field, but it's a much more general property. In fact, it holds also for an interacting quantum field theory. There are various ways of showing it. The formal way that I was mentioning is a path integral way, but the essence of the Bisognano-Wickman theorem is really this expression for the vacuum. So in particular, here I'm calling omega, state omega, the vacuum state for an theory. In particular, interacting quantum field theory of gravitons and matter fields. So I'm using the variable phi L to mean both of them, and you have states that in a Schrödinger representation are states supported on the components of the field on the left and on the right of this separating surface. And the statement is that left and right components are entangled, and the coefficients in this expansion are given by this matrix elements of e to the minus pi k between phi left and phi right. Now, why it's interesting to write the Minkowski vacuum in this form? The reason is that in this form it is immediate to compute the reduced density matrix of the vacuum state when one traces over left modes. In fact, one can write it as an integral over less to mods of phi L dot the vacuum modulus square. And from the formula above, you see immediately that this is given by e to the minus 2 pi k of z. So it has the form of a Gibbs state, of a thermal density matrix, with a temperature that is 1 over 2 pi, with respect to the Hamiltonian that is the Boost Hamiltonian. And this is a very general statement, let me stress it again. It holds also for an interacting theory, and what it relies on is stability of the Minkowski vacuum and Lorentz invariance, exact Lorentz invariance. And this is what's behind the Unruh effect. In fact, if you recall what I was explaining before about the energy measured by an accelerated observer, this is not simply k, the energy is acceleration times k. That means that this observer is a density matrix that has a temperature now that is A over 2 pi, acceleration over 2 pi, and this is the Unruh temperature. Other questions on this slide?
I have a question. It's Laurent. The equality that rho 0 is exponential minus 2 pi k, when you say it holds for interacting quantum theory, do you mean just at first order in perturbation theory, or it's, you know, a non-perturbative result in the sense that it holds all the time at any order in perturbation theory? And if so, under what conditions?
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. So the strongest result that I know of is a result in algebraic quantum field theory, is this Bisognano-Wittmann theorem. The assumption that one is making is that the theory is Lorentz invariant and has a stable vacuum. So they are very minimal. And what one shows, one is careful, very careful there. One doesn't speak about a density matrix. One really speaks only about properties of correlation functions, about the fact that the correlation the two-point functions satisfy a KMS property. They have a certain periodicity, certain analyticity properties and periodicity on the complex plane that correspond to these thermal properties. The point of view that I'm taking is more simple and probably more formal. I know how to derive this quantity in the free theory. For instance, in a free theory of gravitons, one can simply compute it and simply show that the the Minkowski vacuum has this property. And one can push forward this way of doing the calculation order by order in perturbation theory. And one finds that order by order, this is the result. Now, clearly, the fact that you always obtain this result asks for a general geometric explanation. So one is the one that I was mentioning before, this Bisognano-Wittmann theorem. It is a precise mathematical result. And the other is a more formal argument that involves the path integral formulation, where one shows that a state that is the vacuum and is Lorentz invariant has this form just because of the form of the path integral definition of the Minkowski vacuum. So it seems really to be a very general property. And it's a property that I'm going to use. So we can go to slide 15. Now I have all the ingredients, and I can put them together in the computation of the perturbation of the entanglement entropy. It is my part 4. So let's go to slide 16. The point is really, instead of computing the entanglement entropy in itself, the focus is on something else, on how the entropy changes. I'm interested in thermodynamics, and you cannot do thermodynamics if nothing is changing. So what I'll change is the state and consider low energy perturbations of the vacuum state. And so let's go to slide 17. So I consider a low energy perturbation of the vacuum, an excited state that I'm calling E, ket E. You can think of it, for instance, as a one particle excitation of the Minkowski vacuum. So keep always in mind that I'm thinking about gravitons and, for instance, a scalar field. So this could be one particle of the scalar field with low energies, or could be one graviton, or I could go to next order in perturbation theory and be something that involves both. And in particular, one can compute the reduced density matrix for this excited state that I'm calling rho 1. And in principle, compute the entanglement entropy for this excited state. Now, what I'm interested in is how the entropy changes going from the vacuum to this excited state. In particular, I'm interested in the difference between the two. I've tried to search in the literature if there are analyses of this entanglement entropy for excited states. Unfortunately, there are not many. There's a good reason. The reason is that as most of the entanglement comes from high energy correlations, and these low energy excited states are low energy perturbations of the Minkowski vacuum, so they don't change its UV behavior. This entanglement entropy for an excited state behaves as leading order in the cutoff, just as the entanglement entropy of the vacuum. In particular, it is divergent. And when you introduce this ultraviolet cutoff, it will start as cutoff square times area plus corrections, exactly as for the Minkowski vacuum. And the point is really that as the perturbation is only at low energies, it's not affecting the UV behavior and it's not affecting the divergent part of the entropy. Now, I think that this point is interesting, and the reason is that if we focus only on perturbations of the entanglement entropy, then all these ultraviolet parts will just cancel each other in this difference of entanglement entropy of the excited state and of the vacuum state. Will cancel each other, and what remains is just the low energy perturbation. So, even if to define each one of the two terms, one needs to introduce a cutoff or needs to rely on an ultraviolet completion, for instance, on low quantum gravity to compute this entanglement entropy in a theory of quantum gravity, the low energy perturbation, the difference between the two, can be computed only using this low energy approximation, just in terms of perturbative quantum gravity. So how do I do it? Okay, the calculation here is shown in the tail. I'm calling delta rho the difference between the density matrix of the excited state and one of the vacuum state. And I'm considering an expansion of the entanglement entropy in delta rho, a Taylor expansion in delta rho, and truncating everything as leading order. So on the first line, I just have the variation of the definition of entanglement entropy, and this is the sum of the two terms. One where I derive delta rho, and the second where I derive the logarithm. And the second vanishes because the trace of delta rho is zero. Okay, then we can go to the second line where I use the equation for stars. It is the one that is the expression of rho zero of the density matrix of the vacuum written in terms of the generator of boosts. So what I get is 2 pi trace k delta rho. And by the way, if you need a list of all the of all these results that I was discussing before, they are on slide 18. Okay, let's go back to slide 17. So next step, I use the equation with 3 stars, that is the expression of the generator of boosts in terms of the energy momentum tensor of gravitons in matter. And in the third line, I use the fact that using the wave equation, I can express the energy momentum tensor, the integrated energy momentum tensor, in terms of the of a box of the graviton field. So I can consider any excited state that is a low energy perturbation. This would give some energy contribution, some energy flux through the horizon. But because of the gravitational back reaction of the universal coupling of gravitons to matter, I will always have this fourth line, this universality, that is, it can always be, this change in entanglement entropy can always be expressed as an integral of a quantity that is the integral of box H. But before I was telling you about how the area of this patch, the area of this patch of the horizon changes when there's a matter perturbation. It changes in this universal way that is dictated by H mu nu. It is the last line where I write the integral over the horizon of box H mu nu in terms of the area operator, the area of the horizon. And now you see that I have a trace of area operator times delta rho. It is the area, the expectation value of the area on the excited state minus the expectation value of the area on the ground state gives delta area, and 2 pi cancels 8 pi g, so that I get delta area over 4 g. That concludes the calculation that is summarized on slide 18. So the point is really that changes, perturbations of entanglement entropy, low energy perturbations of entanglement entropy are finite and are universal because of this universal coupling of gravity to the energy momentum tensor. So I think I should stop for getting questions at this point. Are there questions on this calculation?
Can you go back to 17, slide 17, please?
Yes.
Yeah. So until you have the equation with 3 stars,
yeah.
I understand it. But I have a problem in going from 3 star to the equation with just 1 star. Okay, let me just go back a little bit. It seems to me that you have a scalar field, and you said you are gravitons. And somehow, the way you presented it, I misunderstood it, but you are thinking that the perturbation is really just gravitons perturbation. But gravitons are really traceless transverse. And I'm missing something as to how they can change area. So the way I understood the calculation, and you tell me what is wrong with my understanding, is that you really have some matter like scalar field. And then with this scalar field, therefore, you don't have a vacuum state, but you have a... you have a perturbed state, right? I mean, this epsilon, and that really refers to this matter field, so to say. And then you come down to T mu nu, K mu, K nu times the volume element, and that is perfectly fine. But then I think somehow you are using the change in the metric caused by this stress energy tensor. And that is not kind of just longitudinal part of the metric, but it's also kind of Coulombic part. It's not just transverse traceless part of the metric, but it's also longitudinal part. It's also something that changes volumes, areas, etc. In other words, I mean, I'm solving the equation block of h mu nu is equal to t mu nu minus etc. etc. And that h mu nu is not just gravitons. It also has this. I mean, it's critical thing is going to be the other part, right? I mean, the Coulombic part, so to say, which changes everything. So it seems to me that your H mu nu is not the graviton field, but H mu nu is really something that you find. In our language, it will be second order perturbation in H, in the sense that, because if I look at perturbations, right, I got first order quantities in H and first order quantities in the scalar field. Stress energy tensor is quadratic in the scalar field. So it changes the gravitational field, not the linearized order, but the next order. And that is what causes all these changes of areas, etc. And if you take, and then everything works perfectly fine. And again, you can avoid this species problem because you're just looking at the total stress energy tensor and so on and so forth in this case. But I don't think that H mu should be thought of as a graviton field at all. It really is this longitudinal, non-quantized, if you like, Coulombic part of the gravitational field, which is sourced by the quantum K team you knew, expectation value of the quantum team you knew.
I completely agree with you. That's right. I think that's right, and it's an important point. So this relation between H mu nu and T mu nu is something that you can derive within this perturbative framework, is the equation of motion for H mu nu. And it is correct what you're saying, that this is not just transverse gravitons. There will be also contributions coming from transverse gravitons, probably at next order, but at the leading order is a Coulomb-like contribution. It is present already in perturbative quantum gravity.
I guess the next question that follows up is then how do you quantize this field H mu nu? Because if it's a graviton field, which is the transverse part, then you quantize it in the Fock-like manner. But now if it contains everything, what is the Fock space it acts on, and what is the quantization of this field?
Yes, that's a good point. That's a good point. Now, clearly one can ask, how do you compute the same kind of phenomenon in perturbative quantum gravity? For instance, if you have some distribution of matter and how stuff gravitates around this distribution of matter at lowest order in perturbation theory. And this can be computed in perturbation theory. There are these longitudinal modes that are non-dynamical, and they are completely determined by the energy distribution. They are completely determined via the Hamiltonian constraint, and they are non-dynamical, and they are present already in perturbative quantum gravity. So I would say that the graviton is unaffected. The graviton, it's not that the graviton gets an expectation value. It's this longitudinal part that gets completely determined and determined to be something that is non-vanishing. So what I'm saying is that it's a quantity that one can describe within this framework of perturbative quantum gravity. I think it's the standard way of taking into account the Coulomb potential. We do it always also in QED. When we have that A0 is determined via the constraints in the presence of a charge distribution.
Yeah, but I think conceptually it might be clearer to just use the semi-classical gravity framework, right, in which you've got G mu nu is equal to expectation value of T mu nu, and you can do perturbation analysis of this. And this is a correction to the metric tensor coming from the expectation value of T mu nu, which, as you just said, I mean, I agree with everything you said, that this really is that H mu nu is being produced by the expectation value of the T mu nu. So that might be a simpler way to say it.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I certainly see two ways of phrasing all this. That is, one is the one that we are mostly attached to, that is the general relativist way of phrasing it. That is certainly more geometric and conceptually more clear. What one gains formulating everything in this language is that while many things are not immediately clear and manifest, you have a clear way of doing calculations order by order in perturbation theory. You always know what you have to take into account of that order. So it's really the other aspect, the calculational aspect, that one gains something in doing calculations this particle physics way of doing the calculations. It is you don't really have to work on trying to see what are the contributions that are relevant in the process and try to identify each one of them, because you have a framework where they are already organized. They are already organized formally in a series in square root of G. So that's what I'm going to, I was doing it. Really take this point of view and see where it leads. Yeah, but I agree with you.
But I mean, just to come back to Laurent's point, the point would be that this H mu nu is not an operator, the graviton Fock space. It really is a C number. It's a C number correction to the background. And, yeah. and so if you can do it particle physics way, but even then you will find that H mu is not a graviton operator. It cannot be because not transverse stateless, whereas a graviton operator is. And so H mu is really kind of a, you know, is a multiple of identity which displaces the background by that amount. But I agree that you can do the calculation the way you are saying.
Yes, yes, sure. So clearly this H mu nu is not the transverse traceless part. I haven't completely gauge fixed and solved the constraints. I'm just in the harmonic gauge. I'm doing things in this other framework. So I completely agree. H mu nu here is not the transverse traceless part of the metric perturbation. Okay. So we can go to the conclusion of this part. In slide 19, I'm just posing again the question, why are black holes hot? Why they have these thermal properties? Why they emit thermal radiation? To the question why they emit thermal radiation, there's a good answer. It is because of entanglement across the horizon. It is slide 20. Entanglement of what of filtheoretical modes across the horizon, and what I'm saying is that there's good evidence that not only the temperature is due to entanglement, also the entropy is due to entanglement, and from this local point of view, that is shown again here in slide 20, when you look at a small region across the horizon, space is just like Minkowski space, nothing strange is happening there. But as shown on slide 21, this state can always be written as this tensor product form between left and right modes with a special kind of entanglement between the two. And the way I presented it is in terms of perturbations, gravitational perturbations about a flat background. But for us in quantum gravity, you can very well think of them as quantum geometries. So a statement about a state of our quantum theory that has some properties like being Lorentz invariant, but also the property of having this structure, quantum geometry, correlations of quantum geometries on the left and on the right. I think this is an important point. It's the point that you can write a state like the Minkowski vacuum in terms of a sum of states that have a quantum geometry contribution, each one of them. They are wild quantum geometries, each one of them, but this specific superposition just describes Minkowski space. This is what this perturbative framework suggests. And in particular, in this calculation, what I was doing is what is shown in slide 22, where I'm considering a perturbation of this state, where what one perturbs is the entanglement between the two parts, and I was showing that the change in entanglement entropy is finite and universal. Now, how is this relevant to loop quantum gravity? Slide 23. I think for two reasons. One is in my loop quantum gravity seminar, in my last loop quantum gravity seminar on the spin form calculation, what I was proposing was really something of this kind. Writing a state, even for a single link, that had exactly this property, having entanglement between the endpoints, the two endpoints of the link. And arguing that if you have a special kind of entanglement, then you can recover Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in spin forms. And to do this, I was introducing a boost Hamiltonian. A boost Hamiltonian that appears naturally as a boundary term in spin forms. And I think that the last paper of Wolfgang Wieland supports this idea. Gives a new way to understand this idea. Now, I think that this is also related to the thermal picture, to the thermal ensemble picture that we have been studying, that a lot of people have been studying in the context of loop quantum gravity, where one considers a thermal ensemble of quantum geometry. If one looks at the problem from only one side of the horizon, then one can look at an ensemble where something is fixed. Generally, one fixes the area, but more recently, this other ensemble has been considered. It is essentially a boost ensemble. Boost ensemble or near horizon energy ensemble. And if one considers this density matrix for this ensemble, one finds that there's clearly an entropy. Now, this entropy will depend on the temperature within this ensemble. And it seems to me that there's something important here. If one starts making an assumption on how space-time is, or quantum geometry is across the horizon, it is described by a state with this specific kind of entanglement, with this geometric coefficient e to the minus pi epsilon n, then what one gets when one considers the reduced density matrix is, first of all, a reduced density matrix exact of this kind that is considered in the ABCK and the EMP calculations and also in the most recent ones. It is a density matrix for quantum geometries on a side of the horizon. Now, what one gains is that this is a canonical ensemble with a very special temperature, with a geometric temperature. And what entanglement is giving you is this very special temperature, this 2 pi. And this 2 pi is really coming from a requirement, the requirement that the state is Lorentz invariant. And this point of view, we have been, so I think that I'm discussing this really because I think it's an important point that I would like to develop more, and I think it's something to invest on. What I've done previously was looking at it only at the case of a single link, but it would be interesting to study it in the case where one considers a spin network and looks at the kind of entanglement that you need in a spin network to attain density matrices of this kind. And this is what we have been working on most recently with Rob Myers. Let's go to slide 24. So the entanglement for spin networks has been studied by William Donnelly. There's a very precise description of what contributions to entanglement entropy you find in a lattice and for a spin network when you consider a region. And with Rob Myers, we have a conjecture that can be relevant for identifying good spin networks that describe semi-classical geometries and quantum gravity and spin points. The conjecture is of the following kind, that in a theory of quantum gravity, in some theory of quantum gravity, if you consider a large region, every large region, large compared to the scale proper to your theory, large compared to the Planck length, and you consider this causal domain associated to this region, and a small patch on this bounding surface that is zoomed here in this picture. And that patch should be small compared to the side of the region, but large compared to the smoothness structure. Then the entanglement entropy has this general form, 2 pi times the area of the boundary over L Planck square. So there's evidence for this conjecture coming from different sides, coming also from loop quantum gravity and from this perturbative calculation I was showing you before. But I think that a good way to use this conjecture is to read it in the other way, read it as a condition, as a probe of semi-classicality. What kind of entanglement entropy a spin network state should have so that the state describes a good semi-classical smooth geometry. Okay, I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much for the attention.
questions.
Let me try. I have a question. I'm not sure I can phrase it easily, but it's about, so here, it goes back to some questions that Abhay had in the beginning, where there seems that there's like three types of surface which are in the game. One is, you know, when you talk about entanglement entropy, there is no reference whatsoever to horizons or other things. So in this last statement, sigma has nothing to do with being the boundary of any horizon. So that's one type of surface. Then there's another, you know, reference when you want to have increase, you talk to event horizons. But these event horizons, they are null and they are theological. That is, you need to know the end of time before you to set up what is the initial expansion of your null rays. Otherwise, they won't reach infinity with the right rate of expansion. And then there's this third notion that somehow you want to do some kind of local physics, so which is this local notion of horizons, but I don't know, they're kind of, I'm confused about some of them. I mean, the question is that you can define entanglement entropy for any region, that's good, but the notion of entropy is useless if you don't have a second law, right? So if at some point, you know, why do we use entropy? We use entropy because it's a measure of something increasing or coarse-grainy. So, but now, so to have second law, you need to use this, I don't know, theological, you know, horizons, the one you were using. But I don't know, I always feel very uncomfortable with it. There's this other notion of local horizons that could be used, but there's also something which is, you know, bothering about them is that you need to have, you know, space-like surface. So I don't know. I mean, the question is more, what's the status here of this, you know, what is this surface, you know? How do you choose it? Is it arbitrary? Is it true for any surface? What's the status of this framework?
Yes, it's a very good question. And clearly, statement is for every surface, I'm applying it to the case of an horizon, but it's clear from the calculation what I'm really using is a set of observers, special properties, so it is observer dependent, and it's a statement about the thermodynamics that they would study, the thermodynamics of the system. So I think one should separate distinguish two parts of the calculation. One is something about the thermodynamics of entanglement that is of this kind. One finds that one can phrase it so simply, entanglement satisfies a closest relation. Once you have these observers that once you have observables localized in a portion of space, then you have that they cannot measure all of space, and they will see a density matrix, and in particular this set of observers will see a thermal density matrix, so they will have a notion of temperature. These perturbations are associated also to a notion of energy flux, so changes in energy. And the thermodynamic statement is that the change in entanglement entropy is equal to the change in energy divided by the entanglement temperature. So this is a thermodynamic statement about entanglement. It doesn't really use horizons, but it turns out that once you realize that there is this teleological notion of horizon, you can write it in a geometric universal manner in terms of the change in area of this teleological horizon. So one can ask again, what is the thermodynamic relevance of this teleological notion of horizon? And I think that this is something that one sees only at a global scale, not at a local scale. At a local scale, what you really have is this first thermodynamic aspect, it is a change in entanglement entropy satisfies the Clausius relation. And once expressed it teleologically, you find it's universal.
Okay. Can I then? I think it's not then a remark which is specific to you, but maybe there seems to me a conflict between thermodynamics and theological. Theological means, you know, you have to know the end of time. It's because we use thermodynamics in a local manner in time-wise. We use thermodynamics to predict what is going to happen to a system. Whereas in so this is really what thermodynamic is, right? It's something which is a determinist, you know, it has some determinism in it. It tells you what's going to happen. Whereas in this business, it seems that, you know, you first have to know the whole history of space-time before you can predict what's going to happen to the system. So in that sense, I find the notion that the analogy with thermodynamics, I don't know, for me, I would challenge the idea that this is thermodynamics. Thermodynamics should be local in time. It should tell you what's going to happen in the system, even if you don't know the future of it.
Yeah, I agree, and I share this point of view, and that's why I was trying to separate the two things. So going back to more standard aspects, one could ask about the thermodynamics of black holes, the standard one, the Bekenstein-Hawking one. And one can ask about the change in entropy of a black hole if this has directly a thermodynamic relevance. Now, you can clearly write the change in entropy of a black hole in terms of change in mass of the black hole. If I drop just a rock in that has a certain mass, then the change in entropy of the black hole is given by the mass of the black hole times the mass of the rock. I'm just taking delta m square if it's a Schwarzschild black hole. And this is something that is local in time. And this has a clear thermodynamic meaning.
I disagree with that because, I mean, in your calculation, you're using a static or stationary space-time. And that's the only reason why it is not theological. I think this is a complete confusion. I agree completely with Laurent that one should not use these teleological notions. For example, I mean, as we know from white dwarf space-time, you can have the event horizon forming in flat space and growing when nothing is actually falling across it. Your calculation will just not be applicable to that because nothing is happening and the area of the event horizon is growing. And so, I feel that really you should not look at event horizons at all. It seems to me that the natural home for your calculation is the following. Namely, you do have a Killing horizon with some topological property. Then it is slightly perturbed and it settles down and becomes a Killing horizon again. In that context, I think with little more work, but I think one can actually redo everything you have done. Because your actual calculation just had to do with the Rindler horizon. And we don't know, for example, it is applicable to Kerr space-time. I don't know how to do this calculation the way that you did it, right? But if you just did it for this, you know, if you like isolated horizon, which is slightly perturbed and becomes isolated again, in that case, the change in the area is given by the formula that you wrote down. And in that case, I think this whole calculation can be done. And therefore, the statement would be that in that case, it is really not teleological. It really is local. But and given this slight perturbation situation, which also fits in nicely with your general viewpoint that you're only doing perturbations.
Yes, I agree. This is very interesting. I'm very interested in looking at how this idea can be generalized or put on stronger grounds. What I was showing is the simplest and probably most naive aspect that is just looking at local approximate Killing horizons. That is something that is already capturing a lot, but I think there's a lot to explore and see what of all this survives in a more complete framework. For instance, see how everything was done in flat space, and the sense is you are really considering a small patch across the horizon and you are neglecting curvature corrections. And one can improve it either taking them into account in this perturbative framework or develop the same idea in a framework that is the one of quantum field theory in quantum space.
Hi, Eugenio. Matteo from Berlin. You concluded that... Yeah. Thank you for the wonderful talk. My question is this. Yeah. You concluded that black holes are hot because of trans-horizon entanglement. If you study the formulas that are behind Hawking radiation, you see that they are the same as for a field in flat space-time with an accelerating mirror along a certain trajectory. I'm not sure what role entanglement would play in that case, and therefore I still remain to be convinced about this conclusion of yours. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I've been thinking a lot about this. In fact, you have a very nice paper on the topic with Carlo, and I still don't have a good answer. I'm convinced that the source of the phenomenon is entanglement, and in the case
Hello?
So I was trying to answer Matteo's question. It's a very interesting point. As I understand it, it's a point about what happens in situations where, like an accelerated mirror, where you have thermal properties, and still it seems that there's no entanglement with another side of any kind. And in particular, there's a very nice paper of Matteo together with Carlo where they discuss this. I've been thinking about this aspect, and I don't have a clear answer. I don't have a clear intuition of what is happening. I'm convinced that entanglement across this boundary bounding surface, separating surface, is important, and it's an assumption about Lorentz invariance. When you put this boundary like conditional that is there's a wall at x equals zero, and then you consider an accelerating observer on the right side of this wall, then clearly there's no entanglement with the left-hand side, but there's also no, the theory is not Lorentz invariant because this wall is breaking Lorentz invariance. Now, I don't know what to conclude from this, Matteo probably has thought more about this, so maybe he can comment more on this if he has clearer ideas. I'm sorry, I don't have something definite to say about this.
I don't either, I'm sorry.
I think it's an important question. It's something that should be clarified. There may be some subtle aspects about time scales and about distance from this wall. This entanglement comes from correlations at very small scales. So if the wall was a bit to the left of this separating point, x equals zero, then you would immediately still have the effect in an expansion where you consider sizes that are small compared to this distance. And then there's another time scale that is the thermalization time, but I don't know how to put these things together and give a clear answer to the question.
This is a trivial observation, but when you have these situations with mirrors, you can always pretend there is no mirror, and there's another side where, you know, you put everything that is needed to create the boundary condition the mirror is creating, and in that case, you could think of the entanglement with that fictitious other side, and you probably get the same result, right?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. I think it's a good suggestion. So this would kill only even modes and let odd modes survive, and the question is if this is enough. And it may be that this is the answer.
More questions? Okay, let's thank you, Jenny, again.
Thank you.